Zoom versus Larkin and Frisch, and we are ready to proceed now with the third case scheduled for oral argument this morning. It is the State of Minnesota versus Robert Vernig. You will each have 15 minutes to present your argument. Counsel for appellant, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. It's important that when you begin your argument, you state your name and identify the party you represent, because we are making an audio recording of this hearing. That is the only permitted recording of this proceeding. So with that, counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
May it please the court, my name is Mark Kelly, K-E-L-L-Y. I'm representing appellant Robert Vernig, who's currently serving a 105-month sentence as a result of evidence located during the search of his residence on April 24th, 2020. I'm here to ask this court to reverse the district court order denying my motion to suppress, finding that my client's estranged wife, Misty Vernig, was acting as an agent of the government on April 24th, 2020, and that the district court finding to the contrary was clearly erroneous. The burden of proof here, clearly erroneous, is met by the record that is before this court, specifically the 737 text messages sent between Misty Vernig and law enforcement between February 3rd, 2020 and April 24th, 2020. The transcript of that meeting on April 3rd, and the testimony of both Misty Vernig and Investigator King at the contested omnibus hearing. What this evidence establishes is that this was far from antecedent contact that is noted in other cases where no agency was found and the Fourth Amendment was not implicated. Now, the district court order of 8 pages long, the memorandum, properly states out the law. And then on pages 7 and 8, the analysis of the district court can be read. What happened was the district court missed the mark, and it's clear to see the district court missed the mark in analyzing the law and applying it to this fact pattern. While precedent is stated in State v. Buswell from the Minnesota Supreme Court is somewhat of limited value because of the necessity of a case-by-case analysis of the facts. The precedent does provide this court with some examples where agency has and has not been found. Now, what the district court did wrong was it focused in on, and you can tell by the italicized language in the order, focused in on at the time of the search. The analysis by this court was focused in on 4 a.m. on April 24th, when Misty Vernig, who resided at another house, trespassed on my client's workshop and office, took a picture and promptly sent it to law enforcement to give them the evidence they've been asking for.
Mr. Kelly, does the record show that the officers were aware of Christy Vernig being there on that occasion and directed her on that occasion to look around for evidence of controlled substances?
No, and the law does not require that we show that. If you look at U.S. Supreme Court Skinner, which is cited in our brief, the Fourth Amendment is implicated by a private company that is following federal regulations regarding testing of employees and then sharing that information with the federal government. That, in the mind of the U.S. Supreme Court, implicated the Fourth Amendment. To quote the Supreme Court, "We are unwilling to accept the state's submission that tests conducted by private railroads in reliance on federal regulations will be primarily the result of private initiative. The government has removed legal barriers to testing, indeed expressed a strong preference for that testing and its desire to share in the fruits of such intrusions. In addition, it is mandated that the railroads not bargain away the authority of those regulations. These are clear indices of the government's encouragement, endorsement, and participation, and suffice to implicate the Fourth Amendment."
Mr. Kelly, I don't know if you have observed, but Judge Larkin has raised her hand and has a question for you.
Yes, Judge Larkin.
Thank you, Judge Bergman. Mr. Kelly, can you clarify the procedural posture of the case? Was this a case in which your client stipulated to the state's case in order to obtain review of a pretrial ruling that the parties agreed would be dispositive?
That's correct.
Okay. And in Skinner, we had was it a blood draw or a chemical test of some sort?
Blood and urine.
And here, your client is married still to this woman, or was at the time of the alleged search?
She resided elsewhere. She was estranged, but they were still legally married.
They were married. She resided elsewhere. Had she previously lived at that property where the search occurred?
About 9 months prior.
9 months prior. And does she have a marital interest in that property?
No. The district court's analysis, and we're jumping ahead a little bit, assuming there is agency, you know, there was some yeah. argument
was
from
the
state.
Was the search unreasonable? Yeah, that's what I'm wondering. Yeah. And granted, the district court didn't need to decide it, given what it did decide. But if we were to agree with you here that there was agency, and we were to consider the procedural context, you know, what are we left to do? Can we send it back and say to the judge, you need to make the second decision here? Was the search unreasonable or not?
Very good question, Judge. And I've struggled with that myself. I really believe that this court has before it a sufficient record to go through that analysis and then ask for a decision consistent with this court's analysis. This search clearly violated my client's reasonable expectation of privacy.
How so?
Okay, so the area in question was the office shop of my client, and it was actually off limits to Misty Vernig, even when she used to reside there. It was locked. It was his private area. It was the only place she told law enforcement, this is the only place he holds evidence. This is the only place that he has his drugs. He has his money there. He does his deals there. I can sit in but this house was also not marital property. It was owned by my client's parents. Okay. So it wasn't even their marital property. But more than that, she had been, when she resided elsewhere, and law enforcement, the record shows, was completely aware of this. They actually went to her house on April 24th, around 11 a.m. She had gotten out of the shower. They said, "Hey, you know, you sent this at 4 a.m. Investigator King wants to know, did you take this morning?" She said, "Yes, I did." So they went to her house to find her. The house elsewhere. She resided elsewhere. So they went to her, the residence she'd been at for 9 months. They didn't even go to my client's house to find her. So in any case, they were aware she didn't live there. They were also aware very clearly in what was exhibit number two I'm sorry, Appellate Court Exhibit 4 is the transcript of a meeting on February 3rd, 2020 at 3 p.m. at her place of work. And she said, I'm not permitted to go in there. I can't get a picture of what you're trying to get. I can't get in there. They said, we want you to do this. There was, she drew maps for them, et cetera. Back to your question about whether or not it would be a violation of my client's expectation of privacy. It's a trespass. It's clandestine. She's told to leave the residence the night before. She goes back in the residence without my client's knowledge. She goes to a bedroom where she's able to actually listen through a vent to what's going on in the office. My client's in there with other people. She indicated at some point in time that I think she uses a cup to kind of listen through the wall even. She falls asleep after some time and she wakes up and realizes he never came back into the house. And then she goes in there at 4 a.m. He's sound asleep. The picture establishes he's sound asleep. And she tells him, law enforcement, he's sound asleep in his office. Here's where the dope is. And then sends it to them. So I don't think there's any way around the issue of the Fourth Amendment violation if she's an agent. The district court focuses in on this page and a half of analysis on this, that some of the facts that were being referenced by Judge Bjorkman, that they weren't present at the time. The incited in Buswell is Walther, which is out of the Ninth Circuit. But in that case, which isn't directly precedent, but is another example, the Rivard, who is an agent of the government who's been declassified, if you will, or taken off the payroll, he's opening up speed packs at the airport, and they aren't there to tell him which speed packs to open, and they aren't there when he opens them. In that circumstance, there was a finding that Rivard was an agent, even though they weren't present at that time. So this question of when the state did a good job of, you know, focusing in on the direct examination of the investigator. Did you tell her to go in at 4 a.m.? No, I didn't. Were you there when she went in for him? No, I wasn't. You know, and then the district court kind of piggybacked all that logic, and it's just not the law. I mean, if the U.S. Supreme Court says that the federal government agency can implicate a private party that owns a railroad company that's testing their own employees, that they aren't involved in any of that testing, but they're encouraging it and they're expressing a desire to have fruits of that search. Now, one other part about that, the Skinner analysis, I apologize, one moment. Sorry about that. I had a distraction. So in the Skinner case, the private railroad company clearly had a business interest, their own real reason for doing that testing. Even if the government was not involved at all with regulations, they want to know what employees are impaired and what employees are using drugs on or off the job. And the state is arguing that, well, Misty Vernick wanted to clean up her own life. She had her own reason for doing this, but every informant has their own reason. It may be that they're getting paid. It may be that they've got a pending charge. It may be that they want to clean up their husband's life. But just like the private railroad company in Skinner, the fact that the informant or the private party has some personal gain from their work for the government that's not the question. The question is whether or not the government is encouraging this. And that's Jorgensen and Buswell. And if you've got, you know, the facts here are so far afield from Jorgensen and Buswell where no agency was found. I mean, in Buswell, there was one meeting some 5 months earlier between one officer and of the 100 security guards that were at BIR Raceway, there was no meeting at all. So there was one guy who kind of ran that security team that was an off-duty police officer. I mean, this government involvement in Buswell was so tenuous. We're talking about daily, weekly, 737 text messages over the course of 2 months, drawing out maps of how this house looked, where to go when you get there, who's coming, who's going, taking pictures of people that are coming and going from the house. This relationship was intertwined and cannot in any way, shape, or form be argued as antecedent contact, like the case cited in a respondent's brief, the unpublished case Hansen from this court.
All right, Mr. Kelly, I'm just going to stop you there because your time has expired. You can pick up on this argument in your rebuttal. You will have 5 minutes. Counsel for respondent, you may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Mike Chisholm. I'm an assistant Morrison County attorney, and I represent the respondent, the state of Minnesota. Misty Verding was never an agent of the state, not before April 24th, 2020, and not on that date, when at approximately 4 a.m., she woke up in her husband's bed, went looking for him because he wasn't there, found him sitting in a room with 2 pounds of methamphetamine in front of him, and she took a picture of that and sent it to Investigator King, along with a text that read, "Woke up and Robert wasn't in bed. I found him in the back office sleeping in a chair and something else you might want to see." She was a private party, a concerned citizen. It's well established that a search by a private party does not violate the Fourth Amendment. However, when a private citizen acts as an instrument or agent of the state in effecting a search and seizure, that's when Fourth Amendment interests are implicated. Mr. Kelly, I will agree with a few things he said. Number one is that it's absolutely imperative that the court understand the timeline and the facts of this case as outlined in the transcript of the Onamia meeting, the text between Ms. Verning and Investigator King, and their testimonies at the contested omnibus hearing. Because it is those facts that determine whether sufficient governmental involvement exists to transform a private search into governmental action. If such facts don't support that, the district court's decision is upheld unless clearly erroneous. The district court's decision was based on a thorough examination of all of the evidence presented and was not clearly erroneous. To the contrary, it was absolutely correct. Looking at the timeline, this began in July of 2019 when Investigator McDonald and Investigator King met Misty Verning at the Camp Ripley Cemetery. Nothing really came of that meeting outside of defining who she was. Ms. Verning was silent until January 24th of 2020 when she reached out to Investigator McDonald, not realizing he was no longer on the task force. That contact led to the meeting on February 5th, 2020, where Ms. Verning met with Investigator King and other law enforcement officers at her work site in Onamia. She provided details of the house that she shared with the defendant. She identified people involved in Mr. Verning's narcotics business, spoke about drugs she had seen, his money, and their relationship. But an examination of that transcript shows that she did not become an agent of the state on that day. The investigators asked open-ended questions, and she did most of the talking. She was never offered money. She was never asked to become a signed-up confidential informant. In fact, Investigator King asked her on 3 separate occasions if she knew anyone that would actually become a confidential informant and do a buy on Mr. Verning.
Mr. Chisholm, I understand these facts. I'm having a hard time looking at the extent of the contact between the informant, shall we refer to her, and the law enforcement agents. And it strikes me that what happened on April 24th of 2020 was really the culmination. I mean, I think that Ms. Verding did exactly what the agents had been asking her to do for months and months and months, and that was take a photograph of the appellant in proximity to controlled substances. why isn't that enough to meet the standard under Buswell or Jorgensen or the case law to find that she was acting as an agent?
Well, it's not, Your Honor, and I'll tell you why. The only request for a photograph was a 47-word sentence in one paragraph in a transcript that took 47 pages to transcribe. And what that request was that the appellant is hanging his hat on is, quote, what we could use is anytime you might be out there in the future or any drugs that you see or even drug paraphernalia that Robert may be in possession of or that you may see laying around, take a picture of it and send it to King. Now, what Mr. Kelly wants the court to do is decide that that is, in fact, what made her an agent of the state at that time. If you examine the text messages, basically what you'll find is that Ms. Vernon sent information to Investigator King that was, for the most part, unsolicited, unhelpful, and unactionable. She simply didn't provide any real information that law enforcement could act on. In fact, law enforcement continually during that conversation, during those text messages, said, we need an informant. We need someone that can go in and get a buy. That's what we need. Now, Buswell, which Mr. Kelly acknowledges is the key case here, requires us to determine on a fact-based case-by-case analysis whether the private person acted as an agent of the state, and that the private party may be deemed an agent or instrument of the government for Fourth Amendment purposes, but that turns on the degree of the government's participation in the particular search. The real question is whether the government knew of and acquiesced to the search, and whether the search was conducted to assist law enforcement or for the party's own private ends. All of the evidence shows that the government did not participate in or know about or acquiesce to the search that occurred on that April morning, nor was the search conducted for law enforcement purposes, but rather for Ms. Vernon's own purposes. Mr. Kelly ignores the multiple cases.
But wasn't her purpose to get law enforcement off her back by giving them the photo that they'd asked for?
No, Your Honor. Her purpose was to go looking for her husband. Because she testified that she hid in his bed for 4 hours, woke up, he wasn't there, and she testified on cross-examination, I woke up and he wasn't in the bed. I went back and the door was open, so I hurried up and ran through and tried to find him. And I seen him sitting at the desk or sitting in the chair, and then there was this large bag of methamphetamine. Her search was not a search for evidence. Her search was a search for her husband, who she expected to have in bed with her at 4 a.m. when she woke up. Now, the holdings of State v. Hansen, Jorgensen, Haney, and Jameson have all narrowed and refined Buswell to show that what is key is the correct application of the first prong of Buswell is that the government knew of and acquiesced to the particular search, that would be April morning, at the particular time it was happening. And there is no evidence that has been presented, not in the Onamia transcripts, the text messages, anything that shows that the officers told her to search at that time, on that date, at that location, or that they knew of the search happening. In fact, Investigator King, when asked what his reaction was to receiving the text and the photograph, he said, quote, very surprised. He was not expecting it. If he had acquiesced to the search, if he had helped plan the search, if he had participated in the search, if he had ordered the search, if he had communicated with her during the search, before the search happened, any of that, he would have been expecting something to come out of it. But he wasn't, because there was no instruction from law enforcement for her to conduct the search at that specific time and place. There was no communication from Ms. Vernon on that time and place that she was going to begin a search. There's no facts indicating that she was actually conducting the search for law enforcement purposes, but rather looking for her husband. There was no communication before or during the search where she requested any sort of instructions or information from the police as to exactly what she should do. Investigator Kane did not know about her activities.
And Judge Larkin here, could I ask a quick question? I appreciate your recitation of the facts that could influence the determination whether or not the alleged search here was unreasonable. I don't see how we would get around fact-finding if we were to attempt to make that determination for the first time on appeal. Did you feel that the facts regarding whether or not appellant had a reasonable expectation of privacy against his wife under the circumstances of this case? Because it seems that's a determination that would have to be made to even figure out whether this constituted a search.
Well, Your Honor, I would argue to the court that Mr. Verding, Robert Verding and Misty Verding were married at the time that this happened. Now, counsel wants to, Mr. Kelly has argued that the office was off limits. She wasn't allowed to go in there.
Counsel, my question is, don't we have to make a finding of fact on this issue in order to decide the issue? Because you're saying one thing, opposing counsel saying another. And how can we do that as an appellate court? So are we kind of spinning our wheels talking about the competing facts on this issue?
Well, if I'm understanding the court's, Your Honor's question, are you asking why he had a reasonable expectation of privacy in that office?
No, I'm asking to the extent answering that question requires factual findings. Is the record such that the necessary factual findings have been made, or is there a dispute between the parties regarding what the relevant facts are? And some court would have to make some factual findings to then decide whether it was a search, whether it was reasonable, et cetera.
Well, I think the district court looked at the Onamia transcript, presided over the contested omnibus hearing, heard all of the testimony coming in, which admittedly, like most testimony in a contested hearing, there's back and forth
did the district court make any findings on this issue? That is, okay, assuming she was acting as an agent of the government, was the search unreasonable? The district court didn't decide that issue, and I don't recall seeing factual findings that would address all the issues that need to be addressed in resolving that question, correct?
The district court basically found that based on the facts that she was not an agent of the state as a result of the Buswell decision and the analysis of Buswell that we find in Hanson, Jorgensen.
So then my question, counsel, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I don't want to take up too much of your remaining time. If this court were to conclude hypothetically that she was acting as an agent of the state, given the procedural posture wherein the state agreed that our review of the district court's decision would be determinative, does that mean appellant wins, case is over, or does it mean we reverse and remand and tell the district court it has to decide in the first instance whether the search was unreasonable?
I think you, the latter, Your Honor. I think you would have to send it back to the district court for a determination of whether or not the search was unreasonable based on that decision. But I think,
can we do that if the state has agreed that the issue decided is dispositive? I mean, we've got a weird situation here where the parties agreed this issue is dispositive, and the issue is whether the evidence should be suppressed as a result of an unconstitutional search, which requires two decisions. One, was she acting as an agent of the government? And two, was there a search and was it unconstitutional? So I guess that's three decisions. The district court only made one decision. It simply said she's not an agent of the state. Now, does our procedural rule preclude us from going beyond that decision to say, well, okay, appellants won on appeal because the district court decided that incorrectly, but that's only one part of the decision. So the state's not precluded from going back and having another opportunity to have this district court decide the remaining two questions.
The Your Honors have to look at the facts of the case and as she applied, or as the district court applied those facts to the law in determining whether she was an agent of the state or not. If she was an agent of the state, the issue of whether or not there was an expectation of privacy or an unconstitutional search based on that, I think is settled because she was not an agent of the state. But further, I am not aware of any law or statute that allows one spouse in a home shared by two people who are married to say, no, you cannot come in this part of the house. You are excluded. I'm not aware of that. So I don't believe he had a reasonable expectation of privacy in that office under the law. And I see that my time is up.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Kelly, you have the last word.
Thank you. In rebuttal, I would submit that Misty Vernig did not get out of bed and go look for a husband because he wasn't in bed with her. He had no idea she was in the house. And the record is clear that she snuck back into the house without his knowledge after being asked to depart. I think that simply is not that statement that she went looking for him for her own personal reasons because he wasn't in bed with her isn't supported by the record. Similarly, the testimony of Misty Vernig establishes that as far back as July 2019, she met with law enforcement and she was asked to do certain tasks and she was pressured into doing certain tasks. And I think that the court, some of the questions recognize that in the transcript. Her testimony is very clear about her fears and motivations and also her feeling of being put upon by law enforcement as either, I'm either going to be on Team USA or I'm going to be implicated with this guy who's stepping over the line legally and I can lose my career, I can lose my standing in the community and these people are pulling my car over for no reason and they're asking me for information and I feel put upon. When she was going to meet with Investigator King on February 3rd, she thought she was going to meet with Investigator King. Three law enforcement officers showed up, a retired DTF agent from Todd County and another DTF agent from Morrison County. The record is clear from the testimony of Investigator King that, and this is on page 108 of the omnibus hearing transcript, that is I'm trying to find the appellate court, but it's the omnibus hearing transcript, page 108, lines 13 through 15. This is on April 21st, literally 2 days before she sneaks into the house and 2.5 days before she takes the photo and immediately sends it to the government. She's not taking this photo. Well, let's get a Christmas picture. Oh my gosh, in the background, there's some drugs. She's not doing it for any other reason. She's taking that picture and sending it to the government in an area they know that she's does a house she doesn't live in, a place of the house she's excluded from by lock. It just so happened that door was ajar and it wasn't locked that day. So she snuck in. Now, on the 21st of April, Investigator King asked Misty Vernig to draw an overhead map of my client's home. And the reason for that was an anticipation of the possibility of a search warrant being executed. This is immediately prior to the conduct of Misty Vernig, where she trespasses, goes into the home without an invitation, without consent, and sneaks into the house, trespasses, and takes the picture and sends it to the government. So this doesn't just come up on its own. There's immediate contact a couple days before, and the government is again expressing they want to get in there, but they don't have the probable cause to get in there. Her refusal to sign up as a cooperating, reliable informant, wear a wire, and do a drug buy is met with, well, there's other things you can do. You can take a picture of anything that was in there and then send it to us. So that's how that comes about. And the fact that she won't sign a formal cooperating agreement has nothing to do with the law as to agency. Look at Skinner, private company. They're not cooperating individual signing a cooperating agreement. If this is an agency, where does that leave our society? The fact that the cops aren't there after they pressure somebody who's a member of a family to get into another member of a family's house where they don't live and send them evidence, where does that leave our society if cops can do this? The reason why, and this is something that Judge Larkin presided over, that Haney decision, the officers were able to say, we never targeted Haney. Marlboro is cited in both briefs. They never targeted Marlboro. They're targeting Vernig. That's the only reason they're talking to Misty, is targeting Vernig, my client. That's the only reason they're talking to the wife. And it's an extended period of time, and it's not antecedent contact.
Right. Counsel, your time has expired. I don't know if you want to sum up in one sentence, but you may do so if you'd like.
No, I appreciate the court's time. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Thank you both for your arguments this morning. We will take the matter under advisement and issue our decision within the statutory 90-day period. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.